Welcome to another edition of Five of the Best. This one's going to be another short one. This one's going to be about hoaxes. I started off thinking this would be a good subject and soon lost interest. There are a couple of good stories here, and but really you should go to the website, and there are stories on the Piltdown Man, and there's not really much of a story of that. And there's a video on the Piltdown Man, which does a very good job explaining what it is. In fact, there's only some like 6 fragments of the skull of Piltdown Man actually found, and from that they filled in the missing pieces a bit like a jigsaw to form a skull. But there's a video there to see, and there's another video, a very famous video in the UK, of the spaghetti trees, and it's worthwhile seeing that. You've got to remember that this was in 1950, I think it's 57, this was made, and in the UK, the war didn't finish in the 1945. There was still heavy rationing going on in the UK right up until about 1952, 53. And for people at the time, exotic things like spaghetti was still a relatively unknown. But there's a great video, so you can see that. And I've also included a lot of other video. If you go to, there's a great show in the UK called QI, and if you want to be entertained and educated, just go to YouTube and type in QI, and you'll find loads of videos. And there's some QI videos on some hoaxes, and they're very good and they're worth seeing. But let's get on with them. Napoleon Bonaparte came against some formidable opponents during his lifetime, but none more unusual than when the one he met in 1809. He played an autonomical chess-playing robot, a chess-playing automaton called the Turk. And the Turk's story goes back to 1770. The story goes back to when Wolfgang von Kempelen, who had access to the Austrian court, and having seen how impressed Empress Maria Theresa was of the automated devices and how they interacted with people, he vowed to return to with his own automation device, which would impress her. And in 1770, that is what he did. He came back with the device that was now known as the Turk. This consisted of a life-sized human head with torso, a black beard and grey eyes, and his right arm lay across the chest, and his left arm, which was the movable piece, was held a pipe. The Turk's movement, it could roll its eyes, it had some movement in its head, and of course its left arm could use its left arm really to move the chess pieces. And the Turk sat in front of a 3-foot high cabinet, and inside this, the cabinet, when it was opened, it was like a musical box. You could see the workings of the Turk, and you can, when it was opened, you could see the mechanisms. In fact, you could open either side, allow the torch behind it, and see right way through the mechanism. The Turk is, of course, the most famous automaton which plays chess, chess-playing automaton. And its first victim was a member of the Austrian court, and he beat him within 10 minutes, and then went on to beat other members of the court very easily. And this led to the story of this automaton spread through Europe, and this led to a tour of the Turk, and it went round all of Europe playing nobles of France, Scotland, Germany, Scottish nobles, countesses, winning some and losing some. This seemed to please everyone apart from Wolfgang von Kempelen, who was very secretive of the Turk and really only made it to impress the Empress, and now it had a life of its own, and he was forever taking it apart and dismantling it, and he had to be ordered to be put it back together again in the late 1790s. I'm going to move forward. The Turk played a number of famous people, including Benjamin Franklin. He played keen chess player and part-time military genius, Napoleon Bonaparte. In fact, when the Turk actually met Napoleon, the Turk actually saluted Napoleon Bonaparte. And they played three games. And the first two games, he was very quickly beaten. And in the third game, with Napoleon on the back foot, he made an illegal move. And at which point, the Turk took the piece and put it back to its original position. And they carried on. Then Napoleon played another illegal move. And at which point, the Turk took the piece and just removed it from the board, and they carried on. And he made a third illegal move, and at which point, the Turk just swept his arm across the board. I'd have loved to have been in the room when that happened. but people still didn't know how the Turk worked in the 1830s. In fact, Edgar Allan Poe wrote a pamphlet on how he thought the Turk worked. The story does continue, and there is a good video which goes into a little bit more detail on site, but needless to say, the later editions, there is in fact a sliding chair inside. The next hoax conned a lot of people and made it into the mainstream media worldwide, and its appeal was that it gave a glimpse into the mind of Adolf Hitler. The story began when an investigative journalism, Klaus Heidemann, is invited to Ufrin Stifel's house in 1979. And when looking at the memorabilia, he is shocked to find that he seems to have the diaries of Adolf Hitler. Heidemann does some research and discovers that the plane, which was carrying Hitler's personal belongings, a Junker 32352, was shut down over Germany. And from this, he goes and approaches Stern, of a German magazine company, and he approaches them for funding to see if he can get any more volumes of a diary. After some skepticism, Stern does give him $2 million to see if he can purchase more volumes of the diary. Heidemann's research led him to Konrad Kudrow, and alarm bells should have been started to ring when he found this out. Konrad Kudrow was a war baby, and he was born in 1936, and he grew up during the war and was always fascinated by the Third Reich and the war. After the war, he went to art college, where he started an art degree and dropped out. After he dropped out because of financial reasons, he started a life of petty crime. Having found a wife, and he started a business, and the cleaning business failed, and his interests on and his collection of the Third Reich is what he made a living out of. He collected this living, and he soon started to realize that if he recreated these pieces, people would pay for them, and that's what he started to do. He started to fake documents, and he started with lesser known Germans, and of course it moved up to Adolf Hitler and the diaries. Heidemann ignored these alarm bells. In fact, he probably suspected that they were fake, and he offered Kudrow an enormous sum of money if he could lay his hands onto other Hitler diaries. And Kudrow accepted, and over the next 4 months, Kudrow produced another 26 volumes, which he gave to Heidemann and in turn to Stern. And although Stern were first sceptical, they were persuaded they were genuine just by the pure number of volumes that were being produced. They did tests, in fact they did handwriting tests. But the only thing is that the handwriting they tested against was against Kudrow's own forgery of Adolf Hitler. Anyway, Kudrow kept producing the volumes, and Stern kept purchasing them. In the end, Kudrow produced 62 volumes of the Hitler diaries from 1934 to 1945. Stern wanted to sell the rights, having spent this much money on it, and people like The Times, Newsweek and News International were all eager to purchase. They did some authenticities of the diaries, and a number of historians said that they were genuine, and Kudrow obviously did his homework very well. When the Hitler diaries was publicised and serialised in the papers, there were huge doubters by a lot of people. It made Hitler a very likable figure, the diaries, and people like historian David Irvine just didn't recognise the person they were talking about. And this led to, in 1984, similar volumes being chemically tested, and through the chemical testing, they found that some of the ink on the paper was less than a year old, and there's the whitening, there's found to be whitening in the paper, which wasn't available until 1954. Of course, this was the game. The game was up for Haidemann and Kudjoe. They were found and put on trial, and they were found guilty of embezzlement and forgery, and they were given 42 months sentence. Yet, having said that, the money has yet still to be found. In 1995, 10 million people sat down to watch a film which was going to disclose some of the stuff which happened in Area 51. And this was the film was reportedly of the alien autopsy of a 1947 reportedly flying saucer crash, which crashed near Oswald, and the US Army picked up the pieces. And this was a film reportedly of the alien autopsy. The story really starts back in 1992 when a young entrepreneur, Roy Santini, heads off to America in the hopes of actually purchasing some unseen footage of Elvis Presley. But while in America, he is approached by an army guy who worked as a cameraman in the army, and he claimed that he had some unseen footage of what happened in Area 51. He was intrigued with this, and he agreed to see the film. And having seen a clip of the film, he went back home and managed to persuade a businessman, local businessman, Volker Spielberg, to part with $100,000 worth to purchase the film. He went back to Hollywood, where not to Hollywood, to America, and he purchased the film and brought it back. But upon viewing it again, he realized that the film, because of the age and the conditions it had been stored in, it completely disintegrated, and this left him with a problem. And his response was to recreate what he actually saw in the film. Roy Santini then hired local sculptor John Humphreys to make the body of the alien, and he did this with the aid of a shop mannequin, which he used as a mold to make the alien itself. He used a lot of grey clay to give the alien the texture and the colour he wanted. And for the internals of the alien, he went to the Smithfield Market and purchased pig's livers and cow bowels. And for the removal of the head to take the brain out, that is in fact a sheep's brain in jelly. When filming the alien autopsy, to make it realistic, when they used a knife, he had one knife pointing to the camera, and the other knife was smeared full of fake blood. And when they cut into the alien body, the surgeon just smeared the opposite side to make it look like it was bleeding. And the whole shoot of the film took 3 weeks, and that was done in a flat in Croydon. The first viewing of the film was at a London museum, and the story just grew and grew, and before you know it, you had people bidding millions for the rights of this, and they just stayed stum. And it's thought that they've made at least £10 million out of the selling the rights of the alien autopsy around the world. And unlike the Hitler diaries, where they were sentenced to jail for fraud, they've just seemed to be got away with the fraud.